honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with 95-year-old Jake Jacobson about a brief period of his life as a teenager that has affected every day since. A glance at his wall in Shaver Lake, California reveals the insignia of the 3rd Infantry Division. You'll also see the Bronze Star, the Combat Infantry Badge, and yes, the Purple Heart, stemming from one cold, dark, painful night in France that we need to explore a little more. Jake, what all do you remember about December 30th, 1944?
We'd gone out the day before and gotten almost captured. And so that day away, he says, "You guys are going out and attacking again." And that's when the sergeant says, "I'm not going to go." He says, they're going to kill us off. You know, that's suicide. So all of us said, "Okay, we're not going to go." They came and says, "I Company, fall out." And we went out there to tell them they're not going to go. And they says, "You guys got it made tonight. You got 4 tanks with you. And you guys, 10 from L, 10 from K, 10 from anti-tankers." So they formed a battle group. So we said, you know, we're going to have to go. So we started, and usually start is after midnight before we went on the attack, trying to help the Germans be asleep by the time we get up there. We took off, and you go behind the tanks because they can knock them out with bazookas or artillery. So you stay right behind them. You swing in behind them. If you go through a vineyard, why, you let them knock down the wire that holds the vines up, or you duck under. And that day they went, I followed behind, and then I moved behind the wire, and I thought, well, I'll just duck under. And I started hangling up with my helmet and gun and things. So I said, I'll swing in behind the tank. So I started swinging behind the tank, and they were loading mortar behind the tank. And the mortar shell went off, and it went through my hand. It cut the tendons in my hand and started bleeding badly. And another guy had just shot through the leg. Another guy had shrapnel his back. So once you're hit, you can leave without a bit of problem, you know. And so we started walking back to the aid station, and it took us probably a half hour to walk back. The tanks went on up and got knocked out one after another, and our lieutenant had a rifle grenade stuck in his belt, and the shrapnel lighted one of those rifle grenades and burned him up. And he was a Congressional Medal winner. They gave him a Commercial Honor for earlier time that he had spent. He's Lieutenant Candell. And so when we went over there, we visited where they'd buried him and stuff, and so he just won. But and then the guy, when we went back to Ben, where there's another Medal of Honor winner, went with us, so It was a fruitful time, you know. But anyway, after I got hit, well, I was one of the last Company I men to come back alive. And I got to the aid station, and the guy was bandaging up my hand, and he says, "How's your head?" I said, "What do you mean, how's my head?" And he says, "Were you wearing your helmet?" And I says, "Yeah." And I said, "Look at it." And I took it off, and there's a 6-inch slit through the helmet and helmet liner, and it hadn't touched my head. So I knew then that, you know, God had spared me again. And he's done many times since then. So there's a plan and a purpose. So
I guess so. And I know you've shared this story before. I know you lived it, and it's been part of your memory for 76 years. But the way you describe it is so matter-of-factly, so no big deal. But you're a 19-year-old kid. That had to be painful when they hit your left hand and the shrapnel severs your tendon. So does that mean you didn't have the use of that hand at that point?
These two, and they connect both of them at the hospital. This one worked and this one worked. They sent me to England and operated again, and it still didn't work. If you wait 6 months for a tendon and don't attach it, it goes on up your arm and they can't do it. So what they did, they took both of these tendons and connected on this, so this and this, both of them.
So your pinky finger and your ring finger on your left hand, at this point when you're hit, you can't move them at all.
No.
They're just dead weight on your hand, and it's bleeding quite a bit. Are you feeling the pain?
Pain wasn't that bad, but this guy that got hit through the leg, he took that, put under his arm, and squeezed it tight so it didn't bleed so much.
And you have no idea that you've been hit in the helmet?
No. It wasn't until he said, "How's your head?"
You didn't feel anything hit
you?
No. And as you're walking back to that aid station, what's going through your mind?
I get to leave. I can get to the hospital and have sheets and food again, you know, because in you're in combat, you don't have hot food hardly ever. And you have K rations or C rations, but you survive.
But this is a moment that almost claimed your life, but it sounds like the most prevalent emotion you were experiencing was one of relief.
Right.
And that tells us how bad the combat life had been for you.
You really think you're not going to make it, you know. You think, but by the grace of God, you do. You know, it's praise the Lord, I didn't have to go back to combat, you know.
So you've lost the use of those two fingers. Later on, they're able to attach them to another tendon so that you can lift them in unison. They don't have their own separate tendons.
This is far to go by itself, and it lifts both of them.
So you had that going on. And then when the medic asks you, how's your head? And you see the hole it was right in the front of your helmet?
No, right along this side.
Right above your temple, there's a 6-inch hole in your helmet.
And liner.
So I've talked to a lot of guys where, you know, a bullet or some shrapnel penetrated the helmet, but not the liner. And it went back out a second hole in the helmet. But you're saying not only is your helmet not just creased, but penetrated, there's a hole in the liner too. But you've got no wound on your head.
No wound on my head.
How is that possible?
God's grace.
I mean, doesn't that defy logic?
Yeah.
Had you ever seen that happen with anybody else?
No.
So what was your reaction at the time when you saw that?
Thankful I talked to the Lord and said, I won't complain about anything again.
So what do you think happened as you try to explain in your own mind how you could have that situation with your helmet and your liner both penetrated but no wound? Was it, do you think a piece of shrapnel passed through parallel and just was that close to your scalp and didn't break it?
Yep.
So, I mean, in that case, if that's what happened, had that been a quarter of an inch deeper?
It'd have been all over.
Am I exaggerating the margin there?
No.
So that's how close you came to being killed that night.
And I've had a number of cases. Probably 8 years or so ago, I had a heart valve, aorta valve in your heart failed. Doctor says you need to have this operated on, you know, within the next 2 years or you'll probably die. So anyway, I went in and I had a pig's valve put in my aorta valve. It worked perfectly for 8 years at least. A couple of years ago, it started failing. And so I went back to the doctor and he sent me back to my surgeon and talked to him. And he says, the problem with you, he says, you're living a lot longer than the pig's supposed to live. And he said, it's failing and we'll keep you comfortable and see if you don't have any pain or anything. After I'd been there, I found out the next day I was supposed to go back to my heart doctor. And so I had the elders lay hands on me and pray for me that night. And I didn't notice anything that night. But by morning, I know something had happened. And so when I got to the doctor's house, I said, you guys might think I'm nuts. I says, but I think God healed me last night. And they says, well, you know, we'll see. So they put me through a stress test and EKG. And they came back after all this had been gone through. The doctor says, this shouldn't happen. They says, your heart is stronger than it was a year ago. Your valve is working better. They said, and that's been 2.5 years ago or so.
Well, let's go back to the last few days of 1944. So you're wounded, and you said you'd spend the next 3 months in the hospital, is that what you said?
Yeah.
What was going on in your mind and your world for those 3 months?
Enjoying the sheets, the good food, the entertainment, you know, movies and stuff you go to. And entertainment in the surgical center was really something. They used true serum to put people to sleep for operations, and every day a couple of guys would go into surgery and then come back, and they were drunk as a skunk. I mean, that stuff made them, and they were trying to make the nurses and stuff in the ward, the one in charge, and it was a real entertainment.
I imagine being in the hospital, too. I mean, there's a lot of time to think about things. Were you thinking about how close you came? Were you thinking about some of the guys that were not going to get to come home? What were some of the things that went through your mind?
First, you're real thankful that, you know, doesn't know where you're going to end up, but you got out, and the war wasn't quite over, you know, at that time, but it was pretty well down, and we joined this MP outfit, and being an MP wasn't all exciting after being combat infantry. But anyway, they were a bunch of older guys who'd been in the Army for 3 years or more and kind of set in their ways. And us kids come in, the outfit was being filled up with 19-year-old combat. But we had the ribbons and the combat infantry badges and what have you. They were almost jealous of us. They had an attitude against us and anyway couldn't do anything for us, you know, and help us until this MP outfit found out it was scheduled to go to Japan. All of a sudden, on the ship going, it took us some 50-some days to go from Marseille, France, through the canals, and we got parallel with San Francisco. Suddenly they thought, oh, all these guys know combat, and we better be making friends with them. So they made real friends with us because they were getting scared because they thought they were going to Japan.
Well, how did you feel about that, going to Japan?
I didn't like it. You know, it was scary, but just seeing the attitude of these guys made it humorous, you know.
You come all the way around, you go through the Panama Canal, you're out here in the Pacific, as you said, parallel to San Francisco, and that's when you found out that Japan had surrendered too?
Yeah, they'd surrendered, and so, oh boy, you know, we're going to get to go to San Francisco and be the first ones in, you know, from combat. But they had a hospital unit that needed to go to Philippine Islands, so they shipped us all over to Philippine Islands and stayed there for 6 months before I had enough points to come home. Us guys that were staying on longer, they transferred a lot of them over, but out of combat, I had to be a company clerk, and they got orders that deactivate this company, and they just put the rest of them over in this big MP battalion over there. Lieutenant and I was in charge of deactivating the company, and he comes and says, do you want to move over there, or do you want to stay around until someone really gets angry that we're not there? And I says, let's stay around. And so he could get a Jeep to go out for recreation at night. So we stayed there for a month or two, stayed till the colonel found out about it. And he called us over and says, what in the heck are you doing? I'll give you till the night to transfer over here. So we got over there. But it was worth it to spend 2 months of enjoying life.
Coming back home to California, seeing your family again. What was that like?
It was really good. Came in San Francisco and going to get out of the service. And this thing had been operated on twice already, was still didn't work. I mean, it hung down. And
your pinky finger would just hang limp.
So when I went through for discharge, he was up in San Francisco. Went through and I says, I want to get my hand fixed up before I go home. They said, well, you're lucky. You know, and I says, I know I'm lucky, but I got the rest of my life to live and I want a hand that works, you know. So they took me in the hospital up there, and they took this thing and broke it all the way down and put a cast on it and left it. And when I got the cast off, you know, the finger didn't work at all. So I still wanted it fixed. So they said, okay, we'll go to Pasadena, the big hospital down in Pasadena. I was in there 6 months before I got out, and they did it, and they transferred it over onto the other tenant, and it worked. And so I got it fixed, but if I hadn't have yelled, I wouldn't have done it, but I figured it, you know, if they could get it fixed, let's get it fixed.
Well, and I'm thinking about, you know, what you shared, how you ended up in farming was you had that injury on your left hand, and then you cut off the tips of your index finger and your middle finger on your right hand. But you also said that when you were in that foxhole in France before you got wounded, you promised God you wouldn't complain about anything else the rest of your life.
I lied there. I guess he must not have cared.
Well, I was going to give you credit for not complaining despite those real difficult circumstances there. And obviously, it's not something that you've dwelled on, if I see all the stuff you've done since and how active you are. But I was just curious about the source of your optimism or perspective to not let those things weigh you down.
I figure I'm here because of the grace of God, plus him taking care of me, and I'm very thankful.
Well, I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you, and I also don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story that only you could tell us. I'm curious, when you think back over 95 years, when it comes to the time you spent in the Army, and this is when you were physically, in theory, at your best, right? You're young, you're full of life, you're strong, and you gave those years to your country and to the people you liberated in Europe. What do you think is important for the rest of us to know about what happened then? Because so many of us didn't live through that. How do you think we should view that time in our history and understand the things that you and all those other guys you were with did?
I believe that was an important time in my life, that I'm made to become who I am. I've always known the Lord, even as a young kid. My mom probably took me to church when I was, 3 weeks old or something. And the importance of then and the importance of now, I found that God is more important than that. But yet that's what made who I am. And I'm so thankful that I've been able to live my life as to him. And I know where I'm going. And if I die tomorrow, I'm going up there. I don't have to worry.
Is there something that after 95 years, as you look back, you'd say that you are most proud of?
Just that I found out, there's more than conventional churches. There's the Spirit of the living God that wants to live within men and women. And he's still available, and he still wants to. Don't neglect that. That's the most important part of your lives.
And is there something at age 95 that you haven't done yet, that you haven't experienced yet, that you're still kind of looking forward to?
I'm looking for the time I go up there. That's something to look forward to and want and expect. And it's so important, so important. If I can leave that with people.
One other question I have, not to be melodramatic or morose or anything, just to get your real view on it, because you talked about how decimated your unit was, how many guys were lost. We heard how close you came to not coming home. Those men who died, how should we remember them all these years later?
What they did for us, it's part of who we were, the country. I think they did to keep Germany from taking over the world, and we would have been entirely different people. Sure, it's tough, but you're thinking more of your friends that you spend, because we were in England with so many of them, and there's one thing that's important is when you have tough things to do, you have to decide with your own mind what you're going to do through it. And when you go to combat, you're saying, okay, I'm going combat. If they're shooting at me, I'm going to shoot at them. And Pat, don't have to start rethinking it when the situation becomes tough. You already figured out what you're going to do and then do it. And you need to set that no matter what things you do. Decide. Decide the tough thing.
Maybe that little exhortation is relevant in your life today. I know it is in mine. Jake Jacobson, 95 years old. You'll find a short video with Jake and some photos related to the stories he shared today at hometownheroesradio.com, as well as the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And the next time it snows in Shaver Lake, California, you'll find Jake out there plowing his driveway. That's all the time we have on Hometown Heroes today, but thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.